Oh yeah, I'm here exercising my treaty rights by the river. There's nothing better in the world to do but to exercise my treaty rights. Oh, will I aim the gaddle me majugwe? It'll be, you know, my majukwadaman and treaty rights some more.
Excuse me, Miss Claire?
Yes?
Episode 8 of Jalasi Mi'kma'ki has started. I hate to break it to you.
But I'm busy fishing.
Well, about that.
Okay, hold on. Let me reel in my fishing rod. Hold on. Here we go. Okay, let's get started.
Upchili dat niga 16 muk 8 episode uchid upchilasi Mi'kma'ki a ola bilingual adlasiewe a Mi'kma podcast a nindeluisi Annie Claire. Welcome to the 8th episode of Upchilasi Mi'kma'ki, a bilingual English and Mi'kma podcast. I am your host Annie Claire. Kiskuk ula episode. Nige weskudumuk uchit treaty a title. Pasan nige upchilasi Mi'kma'ki yuji edlawoge nin 30 minutes. Pasan nige an hour. Pasna tojigisa na anamosig tuninal mugwen gulusin osam gisa nige nigdel lugudijigna. So nige skudumuk kar narami an hour uchit ginu ginanoel treaty seminal a title. When I was a little girl, nobody taught me about my treaty rights. Now, as a Mi'kju, I am beginning to realize what is ours. In fact, it's all ours. We never ceded title to this land. I must acknowledge that some people have devoted their lives to keeping the fight for our treaties and title alive. These grassroots treaty defenders have been so genuine when all around us is the Indian Act system of so-called power. And we dedicate this episode to them. Which brings us to our first guest. Elma Brooks is a member of the Wollastook Grand Council. Whenever I see Elma, I am so amazed by her knowledge and how she carries herself as an elder of her tribe. It's good to have neighbors that do not give a s*** about what anybody thinks. She's like fire. Nige? Nuduwadakusab ebit deluisit Elma Brooks. Kisiguma juinu dleyawit Wollastook Grand Council. At negum nuduwadakusab, daunwan duk jimundu dalikirawik, daunwan deluwit. Dluwit no dangoy grudluwit. At nuttes, nageluk nige ekun wen delamuksit na. Wigit gichu gigwa. Pugel pukto edek ekun ne ebit na. Hello, Elma. Welcome to our show.
My given name is Elma Brooks. My spirit name is, in my language, Zaputakzidapit. I'm Wollastook Awinil. I'm from the Wollastook River, but I live at Ekpahog, which is right in the area of Fredericton.
First, can you tell our listeners a bit about the Wollastook and what has been their traditional relationship with the Mi'kma'?
Well, the Wollastook is one of the most beautiful rivers in this part of the world. That's what the name Wollastook means, the beautiful and plentiful river. We traditionally, it was our highway. It provided us with food. Yeah, it was central to the lives and of our society. We were not nomad. You read in history that we were all nomads around here, but a nomad is somebody who roams aimlessly. That was not us. We were migratory. We stayed in a certain place for a reason. And when we moved to another place, it was for some other reason. So we knew where we were going. When we moved around, we went for a reason, hunting or fishing or gathering. And the relationship with the Mi'kmaq, I believe that the Mi'kmaq probably used the river here to get from this southern part of the territory, maybe going to Quebec or going to Lake St. Lawrence, because the Mi'kmaq, the whole Gaspé, most of the Gaspé is Mi'kmaq territory. And we traveled mainly in birch bark canoes, so if it would be, a really, really rough on the open sea, although they did do a lot of travel in their canoes, but I believe, and I've seen it recorded in many places, that they would have possibly traveled up the river getting from one place to another.
Why did our people call you Maliseet?
I don't know. I don't know why they called us that. Probably because our language is slower than the Mi'kmaq. Now, some Mi'kmaq say that we're lazy speakers. That's how it had been interpreted by some people. I disagree with that interpretation. I spoke to a woman from El Sibuktuk who has taught the Mi'kmaq language for many years. She told us that Maliseet, the closer definition to Maliseet was the gentle speakers, and I tend to like that interpretation better. It gives for a much more pleasant relationship between your people and mine. I remember my father saying one time, especially years ago when the people spoke the language all the time, and everybody spoke the language, it would sound like they were singing. And in some parts of the country, like out west, they never heard of Maliseet, but they did hear of the singing people. Now, it sounded like it was very gentle and soft language, and it was melodious. And it has become more harsh over the years. I would favor that interpretation of Maliseet. We did have a very close relationship with the Mi'kmaq traditionally. Until Europeans came, we shared territory, hunting territories. Our ceremonies were very similar. The culture, the making of the arrowheads and all that kind of thing was very similar. So there was probably a lot of interaction. We would be like cousins, close cousins to the Mi'kmaq. We belong to the same confederacy. There are certain places where the traditional chiefs would have met, the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, the Wollastoqawick, the Mi'kmaq. Mount Carleton was one of those places, and I believe around St. John on Partridge Island, where they used to have annual meetings and get-togethers to sort these kinds of decisions out.
What can you tell me about the Wollastoq Treaty? Are they similar to the Mi'kmaq Treaty, and how are they different?
I believe that it was the Wabanaki Confederacy that negotiated the treaties in the first place, but each of the nations signed treaties separately. The Mi'kmaq signed the Dummer's Treaty. The Wollastoqawick signed the Mascarene Treaty. They're kind of similar. But what they did was, for I don't know how many years, a treaty has promises on both sides in order to be a valid treaty. And one of the other things is that treaties are only signed between sovereign nations. In that sense, it's valuable to us. Our rights never came from a treaty. Our rights come from our title to the land. But the treaty was an agreement that, yes, these are the rights, and these rights are to be protected. And there's promises on both sides. And our treaty, we all have pre-Confederation treaties. In other words, our treaties were signed before Canada was even born. We signed our treaties with the Crown in England. But when Canada took over, brought the Constitution back here, along with that came all of these, they have to uphold the agreements that were signed by England. So that's how Canada became involved in supposedly honoring these treaties. And the Mascarene Treaty, the government, Canada, they hid, or New Brunswick, one or the other, they hid the part of the treaty that the promises were made to us. And it wasn't until about 15, 20 years ago that Andrea Bear Nicholas found the other half of our treaty, the Mascarene Treaty, that made it a valid treaty.
Can you give me a few examples of when your treaty have been important in your life?
Well, it's always been important in my life. I look at those treaties as a connection to our past, a connection that validates the rights that we have. I don't think it includes all of our rights, but certainly at that time, the main ones would have been the gathering and collecting of food, the hunting, fishing, and the gathering. I think that the treaty verifies that were sovereign nations. We are sovereign nations since we never surrendered that right. We have never surrendered or ceded our land. All of those are still in existence. They still exist. I mean, I still gather my medicine. I go out, I gather my medicine. Right now, in fact, I'm starting to put together a medicine chest because you don't know with climate change what's going to be for tomorrow. In many ways, I've always pointed to our treaties for verification, but I don't ever say that my rights come from a treaty. They don't come from the government. They don't come from England. They come from the fact that I have never surrendered my title to my land. And I hear people saying, no, you can't own land. Indians never owned land. They don't have the concept. That's not true, because in my language, Kitak Mikoman, that means my land. Kitak Mikoman, that's my land. That is a concept of ownership of land. So I don't believe everything they say.
Where do you see the future of the treaty going?
Right now, I see things going in all different directions. I see some people like the Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia negotiating a modern-day treaty. Well, I don't kind of agree with that. I think you're weakening your rights if you do that. That's just my opinion, because the original treaties are pre-Confederation treaties, and they're inalienable. But these modern-day treaties, you have the Indian Act elected chiefs. The Indian Act is a federal legislation. It's an extension of Canada. It comes from the federal government. And you see them sitting down with the same government negotiating a modern-day treaty. Well, that's not a treaty, because, first of all, it's only a portion of the Mi'kmaq nation that's doing this. Not all the Mi'kmaq are in agreement with doing that. They're following the provincial government. They're following the government's layout of their own territory. They're going by province, rather than Mi'kmaq territory. It's like Canada negotiating with itself. So I don't know what's going to come out of it. It won't be a treaty. It will be maybe an agreement. When you have that kind of an agreement, Canada can turn around and change it any time down the road when your children are born, or when your children or your grandchildren become the leaders. Then they can say, oh, well, you know, that was an old agreement. It's not a treaty, really. It doesn't matter what they call it. Under Canadian law, it's just an agreement, like you and I sitting down and writing down and we both sign it. That's what my fear is for these modern-day treaties. It's not a nation-to-nation relationship at all. I think that's one of the reasons why the Maliseet Einat chiefs broke away from the Assembly of First Nations of New Brunswick. They're too wrapped up in the federal-provincial system, following that rather than looking at our territory, our traditional territory, which is where the treaties apply. The Indian Act applies only on a reserve. I don't know why they call them First Nations. I think the term First Nations it's not a legal term. It's just something to confuse people, because a reserve is not a nation. It confuses a lot of people. You hear them saying, oh, Six Nations of Maliseet. There's no Six Nations of Maliseet. Those are reserves. I refuse to call them First Nations because they're not nations. They're just bands. In the law, if you went to court, you would say Indian band number such and such. Say Indian bands. That's how they're legally termed. So I don't know who coined the term First Nation. I think it was a mistake for the chiefs to accept that term, but maybe they thought it was going to give them more power or something. I don't know. I don't know why they did that, but the Indian bands did not sign the original treaties. It was the hereditary governments that were in place that signed those treaties. They were pre-Confederation treaties. We have some of the strongest treaties in Canada and the United States. Do you know that the very first treaty that the United States signed, I believe it was 15 days after they separated from England and they declared sovereignty, do you know who the very first treaty they signed with? The Maliseets and the Mi'kmaqs. And they signed it in Watertown. You look up that treaty, the Watertown Treaty. So the United States recognized that we were sovereign nations. I believe that the reason they signed that was to validate their own sovereignty, not because they loved us so much. There's always their own interest is always first and foremost. Still is today.
Thank you, Elma.
Okay.
Thank you, Elma, for opening your heart and sharing things I've never heard growing up. I feel like there are two paths. One is where I am a treaty beneficiary. I hold the title to this land. I am my own sovereign nation in myself. I am as important as any king or queen. Canada acknowledges my sovereignty. On the other path, I am a status Indian. My blood quantum is measured and my Indianness can be extinguished. I am a member of a band and I elected a chief and council who get rich while my people stay in poverty. I am a number and every 2 years a X on a ballot. Nige nigwenemuk ulasid maamigewichtuk igaduk. Nige note nigwek and nigerul majukwademuk uk right seminal at title at me bemigwek at me edek. Uktik path Ned Ligwek at Deluisik Negamoi Indian Act. Basamwelianuk Tamio Basik Edik Nige Bem Nisaik at Nisaik at Nisaik at Bemio Lejutik at Olejutik at Bemixigoldik Basna Apanabanaduk Lupiginal at Abijaduk at Majukwadamuk a treaty seminal at title Nanegmoi Malmugigin at seed Apanamaliaptamuk at Majukwadamuk at gegna masutik at gunjanna. Mene bunia lejuti desnu. At mena anque wadesnu, gunjanna, at kisigu majuinug. At mi majuinug. Danudajik abo onamadimk. At welalio. Our next guest was my neighbor growing up as a child. Her name is Susan Levi Peters. Susan is someone who has followed both paths. She is a former chief and a counselor of my community of Ilsibuktuk. She was Ilsibuktuk's first female chief, but she also walks the treaty path. I know it was not easy for her in politics as a female trying to make change in the community. Midweg ebid gaamaluj saamawidi. Dildaik ebid iginimaden gaamain negam a abo onamano mimajuinug. Milky trimawi abo onamano umsudwino a paskududlawi. Welalin Susan Dandil Agnudumbeg Agnumegal Glusuan Danuda Nuduminen Ninen.
Nindelwis is Susan Levi Peters Adler Yusuktu.
Gistlimides Gildangil Dildain Maui important to Gliman Mimajuinu Uchidam treaties.
I don't need Nudumayab and myself personally maybe 20 years ago. Dangway Maui important Derig at Limanona valid Erigo. Like Nego, we were taught that Edigo, but I'm not really ever get a new open. Tandil mean every go, like Bugo Kaish, Gaydudic Tandil mean every go, really. Meda Gaydud is no more, my old age one and deno. So Nego, I'm a spagino interpreter. What I'm saying, like, what does a treaty mean to you? Nego, no, that I see more Gaydudic. Gigamani na bugo nemi guys kasi gaydo dish pas mo shuro ti kasi net kerona because the Indian Act system na kerona we were brought up 150 years with daddy, so that's kind of drilled in us na confusion. But the treaties need to be aish ginuk jid neno dan dilua ala exercise wat neno what they're saying.
Kis limit the skill dang ko ege sabudain uchitan uchikil elman treatisel.
My God, like Ninimabin, for a long time I knew them. Like I said, about 20 years I didn't exercise them at Muninimwaban and Kamulamunka, Dandil Minerigo, really, until Samawianek, Naduju, Medallion, Missink, Jill Oval Interpreter Waluk, La Medallion, in the community, I used to explain what I remember not really Dandil Minerigo, Muna Indian Act, La IJ, it was given to the chiefs. Treaty time to say that they're in a peace and friendship treaty with this country. Now, medallion, France, Wajit. So, Wenush, that's why, now, Wenush, Canada, they have a strong voice because of that. Other than that, now, we're going to meet Okoyeg, and they're Wajimodiji under these treaties. Banado of Ga and to the parliament. Parliament Bisquali in Samaria Nega Domoaj without an invitation but a Bazagewegna that medallion Iwagedwap treaty and Dojibul the other is Supreme Court Marshal you know it was ruled using a treaty so that became valid now fishing in Minala I'm going there should be in a debiachten Dujwa exercise award in a rights in Minal Nige Dike Mestil Mobilivo Adu Kino Nige Auna Aimuri Kino Mobilivo Adu Kai Divia Allah La Amos Pagedlam Sada Utigo Meda it saved us for 500 years and it's gonna save us another 500 years. Milkina Almeda Dilua it proves this is our country. Ma Gisleuk Silkika Dileuk Sigi Akino Ma Amigo Minua a Krisor Seminala a Kubino supposed to be Mali Aptimino Mina Axulio A Minua Mina I Piga Daikan Basna Mudaru Job Negama Auna Adimuksig Ujinig Mudleo Tuk Tetigausi corner it to a you know residential school and the whole 9 yards everything Gaia is you gave Fido Auksig and everything so Minchi Daik Nige we're awakened like to Amushpa Migamoa even across Canada, east where the sun rises. Ontario, Quebec, until after Canada born or became a Canada, form a confederation or whatever they call it, whatever those words are. They're not even treaties because they're just agreements. That's not daily magic. They are treaty 10, treaty that. No, really, na negamo. Their treaties are with England. They don't. Basa mislead awa ujik negamo. Na ginawa una apokchi two clubs na sutiga until 1996 Marshal Neyado back in court, Elado Supreme Court with the chiefs of Atlantic Canada. Mawidajiga deluajiga. We're gonna do one case to see are these treaties are they really as strong as we think they are? Na Marshall IG Dil Donald Marshall Bibani Madi La Ajiguida Medla Jin and Gizi Guida Mebam Sequakis Lablusan Wet Atna na Elliot Ajiguida Meda Akedlo or support to Allah Dil supposed to be a Abu Omwad and they did get on a Mawidam Kabam Sequoia Abu Omwad as much as possible. We know we got the case won and he won that proved our treaties are valid. Hey, I wanna make sure these treaties are what they are. But now, auna abwalari lo negamo gubernola glimkun da nilo glua Allah treaty lo gizne gubernola gizne Supreme Court glimkun do giz amushpana gino delimukki. That's what Marshall told us. You know, this is your land. This is your right. You go exercise it and be responsible. And that's where we're at. Nigeya. Pasa mushpa gigmani na mana yuzi estado do elugudio kero eliapta anoksigi. Gubernol exulio eminu yuzi mali apte muksi na detuksi na. They can't get away with it. Just because old dike treaty took does not mean the Indian Act mu edenugo edegab na edega still illegal because the Indian Act was made for white people to make sure that the Indians supposedly not be molested or it was made for the Queen to make sure that hey nobody comes to Canada and takes the land over Tluek in a sense from the Indians because we were the poor Indians in her eyes back then. Probably call it the seventh generation, or I don't know what you want to call it. But what dugiati you guys, the young generation, maybe dugiata, they're going to wake up more because they're getting more educated at a younger age. At the treaty with school, they go. No, she needs some more reading. Jamuneya was school in media government until 1990. In the late was school in media, they would talk about these treaties and all, but they were not talked about so much as the relationship was but now you know it was all Indian Act when I was chief and when I was a counselor now everything was done under the Indian Act. I knew the treaties before I even became a counselor but I read but I did not know them in my heart and I did not believe what they were until I believed them really. Once you really read them I interpret a lot on and a gate on that hey wrong, what's happening? It's wrong. Oh no, no date. Old age. Mushupi, but your old age. And no. Get him in the treaty. Monodano, we in court to prove that, you know, mommy go, you know, gonna start off now, you know, and no, me go, a more demonic. When you scare more demonic, wagala say, you know, that way, like, so, nigga, a more diga, nigga, dugia diga, me, dugia diga, is me go, me, nah, that was school, like, that's the friendly giant that they're talking about that's gonna wake up. Well, it's awake. It just doesn't know right now. Friendly giant is the treaty, peace and friendship treaty. It's just that we're kind of confused, I think, what's happening. And I think now it's, and pretty soon the provincial government and the federal government are still telling our leaders that we have to prove this is our land. Like, we don't have to prove it anymore. We've proven it already. What we have to do now is let's get to work and let's implement the treaties.
Well, Ali, that was Susan Levi Peters. Thank you again, Susan. We spend the next half hour talking with Kevin Christmas. I feel so fortunate to be able to share Kevin's words with a wider audience. He is a true treaty scholar and protector whose research and knowledge are of incredible value to the Mi'kmaq nation. Kevin Christmas, Nigeluwi Lilu Kamulamun, Kejiru Dangoi Uchit Mu Uji Gulula Ega Adlasio Ka Delima Ekoi Uchit Treaty A Uchit Title. Ede Model Tekunuk Agunudumano Adlasio Danginu Nogama Weskudimidish A Tanges Gisa Weskudimidish. Ginu Apana Mauko Bidaik A Agunudamadik At Delim Tutik Uchi Treaties La Title, Dama Adlasio supposed to be Negamok Chi Dudno. It is supposed to be Mogigil Nemino, Nogoma, Umsit Negamok supposed to be Chidno, at Maui Abotanamadotno, at Agonar Madotno, Angobidano, and a gay do dango Uchi Ran Moji Gulusik Uchi Negamoi. At Wellalin Kevin, at a Gijul, Ukamulamun, Edek, Maliautimino, Dango Inigilekum and Daninanginami Desnin. At Megat New Wellalin,
Thank you, Kevin. It's an honor to have you on my show.
Yeah, I'm Kevin Christmas from Member 2 in Unamagik.
What is the most important thing you would tell the Mi'kmaq people about our treaties?
I think the most important thing that I would tell our people is that the freedom they want and the freedom they deserve is available to them already. There's nothing that needs to be changed by way of our treaties and by way of our rights and by way of our guarantees that's going to keep them any better than what our treaty is doing. So the most important element, I think, of the treaty is that it's guaranteed forever, even longer than Canada. My point is, it can't be touched by any of the politicians today. And it can't be ignored because it's law. And it cannot be put aside for another law because it has more precedence than any other law in this nation. Most of the stuff that I've learned over the past 40 years, I only came to appreciate and understand it in the last 10 years. And it was only because of the grounding in the previous 30 years that I was able to see beyond. And the point that I'm making is there is more in prehistory that is saved in the oral tradition of our people than what is written by anybody. And that's where you begin your understanding. You begin your understanding with the elders. And you ask the elders what words mean and what their intention is, the way they're being used in these sentences. The way our people keep their oral tradition is within the families. So you have to become very intimate with a certain family if you want to learn that certain thing. Our prehistory is spread out traditionally amongst all of our elders and their families. So it's a lot of work to get it right, but you only have to do it once. And if one person is able to pull it all together for you and can help you, then that helps you a whole lot. But you won't find, I would say, about 50% of the stuff that I know, you won't find in any book. That's the problem. There's a point where we stop talking about it.
And is there a reason?
Yeah, there is a reason, because you come eventually to the point where you talk about yourself as a true human and you talk to your spirit about what that means. And to me, the true human is the closest characterization to Jesus Christ, actually, that I can think of. The way that the pure, true human life that was lived by Christ is the closest I could come to comparing the ideal treaty lifestyle. You got someone who is independent, not associated with any government, is not subject to any governmental rules anywhere, makes his own way, speaks freely on behalf of Creator. That is, I think, a noble ambition for any elder. And that's what we value. But it comes to a point where it's just elders to elders, and the talk is very intimate. It's very much a discussion about the state of the nation as a people. I grew up at a time when there was a lot of misunderstanding around being Indian, but we never associated being Indian with being treaty, and we never associated being treaty with being Indian Act. So the first thing we had to sort of discard was this identity around the Indian Act, that the Indian Act is a false identity. It was created to get rid of Indians, not to make Indians. So when you look at that contrast, remember, as a young fella, my buddy's coming back from residential school after being beaten and abused and basically had their life pounded out of them. When you sat and talked with them, what they said was something that you tend to forget. They said, "We had to comply to survive. They were so violent that they would have killed us." And that's, you know, something I'll never forget, is these young children being beaten up by adults because they didn't think that they were worthy of being regarded as human beings. And to think that our whole ambition in life is to be a true human and to have that beaten out of us by people who thought they knew better. So that's what drove me. What drove me was those kids trying to survive in war. The other thing that really bothered me as well was when I used to see the elders' helplessness. That's what used to really bother me too. They were always measured by consumerist ethics. They were measured by how much they had, what they wore, you know, who they hung with. A lot of our people in that time, they were very poor, very, very poor. We weren't allowed to have bank accounts, and everything was done by government ration allowance, and our people were miserable. When welfare came in 1970, it really triggered something. In my community, the only way they could get money was to go to Maine and pick blueberries in Maine and potatoes and work the farm. And that's the only way they had cash to buy stuff for school. But the thing that really bugged me was that the elders that gave everything for their families, they were the ones not able to get on with this consumer-based lifestyle. So they were exploited a great deal. I found that when they were forgotten, it's like all of their memories and all of their ideas and all of their hopes for our people fell down by the wayside, sort of fell off the wagon. It was activists inside the community defending our people against the abuse of the system that created the political movement. It was how we were treating one another. It had nothing to do with how Canada was treating us. It had to do with how poorly our people were treating one another. And the elders, when they came out and started to speak, that's what they said. They said, "You're forgetting how to be a true human, how to feel compassion for people. You're forgetting how to work for people. You're forgetting how to support one another. You're forgetting how to make peace. And you're forgetting your ceremonies." And those are the only things that brought us through this oppression. And they said, money is just going to bring oppression. It's going to bring the hardness to our people that wasn't there before. And that's going to have a real impact, they said, on the young women. Because the young women, they grew up believing that the young men in the reserve were there to protect them and that they can go to any of them to get help. And that if they were being abused, that somebody would stand up for them and fight for them and defend them. But you know what? They didn't. And we had a lot of young women that were basically abandoned in their life. And they had nobody advocating for them. So we had to form the Native Women's Association because of what was going on with the Indian Act and the abuse our women were encountering, our young women were encountering in our community. And again, all of these organizations and political movements came as a result of things going wrong on the res. It had nothing to do with anybody coming in and demanding that we all act like white people. It came down to us not acting Indian. That was the problem. And to this day, it bugs the hell out of me. In 1970, our budget in Member 2 was $77,000. And that took care of all of our community's needs, all 400 of us. It met every salary. Everybody was paid. I mean, it wasn't big money. And then here we are, 40 years later. Member 2's budget last year was $105 million. And we still have just as many people on social as we did back then. And we got about 600 employees working for the band. Majority of them are white people. And Member 2 has become sort of the consumer mad dog of all of our communities. If you bring up treaty, if you bring up the Indian Act, they treat it like white noise. When you talk about consultation, being Indian, they talk about that's just white noise. And I didn't know what they meant by white noise. But white noise is that background humming, buzzing that you can't understand. And when they were talking about consultation, consent, when they were talking about those things that were critical to us, all of the people that were running all of these organizations saw it as nothing more than white noise. So now the government's got caught, and they have to genuinely consult with our people. And our people don't take them seriously because of the history of white noise with our own leaders. So I don't know what to say. I mean, the elected leaders that we have right now are not the traditional leaders that I remember. The election system is completely, completely fraudulent. There is nothing lawful that is being done under any administration in this province. And only because all of the decisions have gone behind closed doors. No plans are shared with anybody. Nobody consults with anybody. If the leaders are going around and saying that they've consulted with the community, don't believe them, for God's sakes. I mean, they're in Member 2, we had about, I can think of the last dozen community consultations, and I think the same three people showed up for each one of them. And they're making policy decisions that are going to affect this community for a long time. And because of the history of white noise and ignoring the community is now ignoring them. So how is government going to justify their priorities when nobody's talking to any Indians? That's what I don't understand. Like, I spent 25 years not talking to one white person. I only talked to Indians because I only wanted to Indian ideas in my mind. And I only wanted to hear Indian people talk about these things. I didn't want to hear anybody else's ideas. And what I heard filled my heart, filled my spirit, filled my soul. I mean, the stuff I learned from our people by chatting with them and talking with them and asking them questions was far more than I could ever learn from a $1 million study by government. So, no, I don't go to meetings. And I don't listen to techies. And I don't listen to the white noise. But we still need to be consulted. And we still need to get the good advice. And we still need to do our own research. And we still need to produce our own priorities and objectives and goals. And right now we're disabled because all of the institutions have stolen our thunder. Every institution that's become involved with us has stolen our leaders. Everyone. Whether it's Indian Affairs, the tribal councils, the band councils, the Mi'kmaq Family Children's Services, Dalhousie University, St. Mary's, all of these institutions and all of these agencies, Every one of them are serving the institution's needs and not our people's needs. They trained all of the curriculum teachers. They trained the teachers specifically to design a curriculum around treaty, for instance. They started the program 30 years ago. We have not seen one curriculum come from one teacher in 30 years. So the institution killed that in them. How the hell did the institution snuff out that person's identity? Why are these institutions believing that their interpretation is the only interpretation? You know, when majority of our people don't know anything about treaty. Nothing. I mean, I'm amazed. And all they have to do is go and pick up one treaty and go and ask somebody who knows about that and say, explain this to me. Why is this word submission, for instance, in there? Do you throw it away because that word submission is in there? Well, how can you square the word submission with the word forever? How do you square that circle? Well, when you look at the actual discussion, you have an English person talking to a French priest. The French priest takes what the English person said, translated into Mi'kmaq to a Mi'kmaq person. The Mi'kmaq person responds in French to the French person. The French person responds back in Mi'kmaq to the Mi'kmaq person. And then the Mi'kmaq clarifies it to the French person, who goes back to the English person and says what the Indian people said. So you got five interpretations, and it's still not an Indian talking. It's somebody talking on somebody's behalf. But when you look at the record, you see in the record how every word was measured, how every word was perfected. And the words that were perfected in the treaty are French. Do not read the English. Go get a translated version of the French and then have that translated into Mi'kmaq. That's how you find out what's in the treaty. You just don't pick up the English copy, read it, and say, I'm not going to read anymore because the word submission is in there. But there's all kinds of submission. Like, people submit to the church. People submit to the law. People submit to parking tickets. I mean, there's a million and one ways to submit. And if I wanted to betray you, I would write, you submitted to me. That's how I would betray you. Because you look in our treaty, and for instance, you won't find any Mi'kmaq government in the treaty. You won't find in the treaty that the Mi'kmaq Grand Council has been assigned the responsibility of granting our treaty rights to our people. Okay, you will not see that. What you will see is that the Grand Chief, who exercised the prerogative on behalf of our nation, you have in the treaty where his rights are guaranteed to the descendants of the treaty, to his descendants. On the English side of the equation, you have the king's authority being sent down to a government. So you have the king's prerogative authority being sent to the Parliament of Canada. And the Parliament of Canada is an elected government. So the cabinet of the government exercises the power that the king, discretion, the cabinet has that today. They use it today to ratify international agreements and treaties. The latest conservation treaty, for instance, in Paris, that would go to cabinet to be ratified for the interim, so it doesn't have to go to parliament to be debated in parliament and then voted by parliament. Well, that same prerogative right that cabinet has is in the person of the descendants. So you and I have the same authority as the king in our land. Now, as the person of the king, which we are, we have international prerogatives and rights that come with that. Now, the reason we can declare that today is because we still have Aboriginal title. So in the treaty, you will notice, for instance, in 1762, Elsa Booktook refused to come to Halifax. They were known as the St. John River Indians at the time. But they refused to go to Halifax until the question of title was addressed. So they would not allow the treaty to be taken into the communities and ratified in the communities, which is the only way it could be made legal. And they confronted the governor at the time. So the governor decided what he would do is he would go and seek instructions from the king. And the king sent back instructions called Belcher's Proclamation. And the instructions to Belcher was that only the king can gain access to original Aboriginal title. But the king was only a preferred customer. The king was not title owner. He was the one that if we decided to sell in the future, that we would call him first. And we agreed to that, knowing full well that we would never put up our land for sale. So it was sort of an empty promise on our part. The English needed hope at that time. So they got it. Now the problem is, when they set up their government, there was a great debate going on about 100 years earlier that happened in Boston. And it all had to do with our treaties. The people in Boston didn't want to pay any more taxes to be given so that goods can be given free to the Mi'kmaqs. So they were fighting this whole time. They had the Boston Tea Party. They decided that they were going to sever their ties with England. So England had a real problem of how to raise taxes and raise money to pay for the settlement, but especially to pay the Indians off. Because the Indian people would not let them leave Halifax or Annapolis because they were venturing into Indian territory and Indian hunting ground. And they were specifically prohibited from going into those grounds because war was still going on. And they pissed off a lot of people when they got rid of the Acadians. So the long and the short of it is, by the time Confederation rolled around, you had this 100 years of taxation going on in Canada. And they couldn't figure out how they could get around this idea that the Indian people still retained original title. So they created a lie. And the lie they created was originally developed actually by a guy by the name of John Locke. And John Locke was an American. He wrote this book on democracy. And in the book, John Locke discussed this whole idea of tenure and title. And what he said in the book was the government has to come up with a lie to justify in Canada the manifest destiny that was going on in the United States. That because they were a Christian nation that they could take over the land because they were savages. Well, that didn't really work. So what they came up with in Canada was something called fee simple. And that means that you were given a crown grant on a certain amount of land. And the government basically guaranteed you that if anybody came and claimed that piece of property, that they would defend you and that property. They didn't guarantee they'd win. They just guaranteed they'd defend you. So if you look at every deed in Nova Scotia, every land deed in Nova Scotia, you'll see in all of those land deeds where the crown is saying and assuring the people that if you occupy this land for settlement or for farming or whatever purposes, that the government will protect you and take care of you and defend you, but it's going to cost you taxation-wise. So they made it mandatory that everybody has to pay tax if they're occupying a piece of property that was given to them by the government. The problem was, in Nova Scotia, every one of the sites they chose was a primary Mi'kmaq site. They took the best sites. They moved in where our people were living. And our people had to move out because they lived side by side until the resources were depleted, until the wood all around them was cut up, until there was no more animals left. So they couldn't live the traditional lifestyle because of these people living next door to them. So they had to move, but they couldn't move into a territory that was already occupied by a Mi'kmaq family. So they had to move up into the common grounds. And in Nova Scotia, there were three common grounds. They call them the hunting grounds. But they moved into those hunting grounds. And that's where you'll see Shubenacadie, Millbrook, especially these bands in the central part that moved into the central grounds away from where the settlement was happening around Halifax County and down in Lunenburg. But that was the problem. The problem was displacement. And it wasn't just displacement of where they had lived, but it was displacement of their cultural way of life. And then they had to go into another area and they had to displace somebody or they had to be involved in discovering a whole new lifestyle in an area they weren't familiar with. So you had this going on. The more settlers moved in, the more displacement happened. The more the displacement happened, the less the government gave a damn. So none of this transactions that were going on with all of the Indian people and all of the settlers, nobody really kept record of the Indian side of the equation. So you won't find, for instance, in a lot of these deed searches, you won't find any evidence of Mi'kmaq complaining, for instance, and saying that this was the Johnson's territory or this was the Denny's territory, because they had all been displaced. So when you start looking at the records and looking at the record keeping that was going on, it was all intended to cover up this lie that the federal government could defend you and would win if you agree to pay taxes to them. That's the lie. And this is why today we have oil companies now and we have pipeline companies now saying to us, we need your consent. And the Indian people are looking at this and saying, okay, well, who are you choosing to consult and consent with? You're choosing institutions that are self-serving. So no matter what happens by way of white noise, you're still going to get the protest registered because the original right is not being regarded as originally owned by our people. You see, we were never given any rights from Canada. We gave Canada their rights. We said, you have a freedom of settlement and only you have it. You can go and live wherever you want, and we won't bother you. But think of this like you're staying in a hotel. Doesn't matter how long you stay there. At the end of the day, you don't own the hotel, and you don't own the room, but you can do anything you want in that hotel, provided you pay the bill. And unfortunately, right now, the bill has to be paid. It's past due. And I'll tell you, the debt that's owed is in the trillions. And Canada cannot pay it. So what are we going to do? We're going to sell, let's sell, I don't know, Sydney. What do you think we can get for Sydney? Or Moncton. Moncton, you know, you've got French people in there. Or, you know, maybe we could sell them back their dams where they've ruined our rivers. Maybe we can sell them back their pollution. But I think this would completely eliminate any money left in the bank by any Canadian. So the best way for Canada to deal with it is to accept the fact that the Indians have title and damn it, we can't pay them for the land, so they're tax exempt forever. Period.
Thank you, Kevin.
Okay.
Nigan Kobiedel 6 Sangwan. Toji Wuli Wulag. Toji Wul Nijisuik Sangwan Kumihto. Kelo tango igis nu demuk nige. Tango igis is good. Kevin Christmas uchi dam treaty a title. Nige ginu nu da pas nige smena a six sedemun a banad no si jawa nui na. A selgina mautino. A eomino. A akodemunish. Mudam pas tili igin munish win. Kunjan na majuinu dumk upon a negamo kigina music. A kinu gegina masuti. This is the end of the show of Jalasi Mi'kma'ki on treaty and title. I would like to thank Kevin Christmas, Susan Levi Peters, and Elma Brooks for their amazing knowledge and wisdom in our treaties and title. And I would like to thank everybody for listening. May you all have a good day and take care.